company. I came along after I knew about Donna and this guy Kemp, partly because I wanted to keep up a front. I guess no guy wants to advertise when he finds out his wife has been getting it on the side. But mostly because I knew that the people who depend on us have to keep eating, no matter who my wife decides to go to bed with. Go easy on yourself, Vic. Stop digging yourself with it. I can't seem to do that, Vic said. Even now I can't seem to do that. And I can't just go on to New York as if nothing's happened. As far as we know, nothing has. The cop kept emphasizing that to me. You can go on. You can see it through. Maybe it'll turn out to have been nothing but a charade all along, but people have to try, Roger. There's nothing else to do. Besides, there's nothing you can do back in Maine except hang out. Jesus, it feels wrong. It feels all wrong. It's not. I'll call you at the Biltmore as soon as I know something. Vic zippered his slacks and stepped into his loafers. Now go on and call Avis for me. I'll catch a cab out to Logan from downstairs. Here, I'll write my Amex number down for you. He did this, and Roger stood silently by as he got his coat and went to the door. Vic, Roger said. He turned, and Roger embraced him clumsily but with surprising strength. Vic hugged him back, his cheek against Roger's shoulder. I'll pray to God everything's okay, Roger said hoarsely. Okay, Vic said, and went out. The elevator hummed faintly on the way down. Not really moving at all, he thought. It's a sound effect. Two drunks supporting each other got on at lobby level as he got off. Extras, he thought. He spoke to the doorman, another extra, and after about 5 minutes, a cab rolled up to the blue hotel awning. The cab driver was black and silent. He had his radio tuned to an FM soul station. The Temptations sang Power endlessly as the cab took him toward Logan Airport through streets that were almost completely deserted. Hell of a good movie set, he thought. As the Temptations faded out, a jive-ass DJ came on with the weather forecast. It had been hot yesterday, he reported, but you didn't see nothing yesterday, brothers and sisters. Today was going to be the hottest day of the summer so far, maybe a record breaker. The Big G's weather prognosticator, Altitude Lou McNally, was calling for temperatures of over 100 degrees inland and not much cooler on the coast. A mass of warm, stagnant air had moved up from the south and was being held in place over New England by bands of high pressure. So if you gas gonna reach, you gotta head for the beach, the jive-ass DJ finished. It ain't gonna be too pretty if you hanging out in the city. And just to prove the point, here's Michael Jackson. He's going off the wall. The forecast meant little or nothing to Vic, but it would have terrified Donna even more than she already was, had she known. As she had the day before, Charity awoke just before dawn. She awoke listening, and for a few moments she wasn't even sure what she was listening for. Then she remembered. Boards creaking. Footsteps. She was listening to see if her son was going to go walking again. But the house was silent. She got out of bed, went to the door, and looked out into the hall. The hall was empty. After a moment's debate, she went down to Brett's room and looked in on him. There was nothing showing under his sheet but a lick of his hair. If he had gone walking, he had done it before she woke up. He was deeply asleep now. Charity went back to her room and sat on her bed, looking out at the faint white line on the horizon. She was aware that her decision had been made, somehow, secretly, in the night while she slept. Now, in the first cold light of day, she was able to examine what she had decided, and she felt that she could count the cost. It occurred to her that she had never unburdened herself to her sister Holly, as she had expected she would do. She still might have, if not for the credit cards at lunch yesterday. And then last night she had told Charity how much this, that, and the other had cost. The Buick four-door, the Sony color set, the parquet floor in the hallway. As if, in Holly's mind, each of these things still carried invisible price tags and always would. Charity still liked her sister. Holly was giving and kind-hearted, impulsive, affectionate, warm. But her way of living had forced her to close off some of the heartless truths about the way she and Charity had grown up poor in rural Maine. The truths that had more or less forced Charity into marriage with Joe Camber, while Luck, really no different from Charity's winning lottery ticket, had allowed Holly to meet Jim and escaped the life back home forever. She was afraid that if she told Holly that she had been trying to get Joe's permission to come down here for years, that this trip had only occurred because of brutal generalship on her part, and that even so it had almost come down to Joe strapping her with his leather belt. She was afraid that if she told Holly those things, her sister's reaction would be horrified anger rather than anything rational and helpful. Why horrified anger? Perhaps because deep down in a part of the human soul where Buick station wagons and Sony color TVs with Trinitron picture tubes and parquet floors can never quite make their final, stilling impact, Holly would recognize that she might have escaped a similar marriage, a similar life, by the thinnest of margins. She hadn't told because Holly had entrenched herself in her upper-middle-class suburban life like a watchful soldier in a foxhole. She hadn't told because horrified anger could not solve her problems. She hadn't told because no one likes to look like a freak in a sideshow, living through the days and weeks and months and years with an unpleasant, uncommunicative, sometimes frightening man. Charity had discovered there were things you didn't want to tell. Shame wasn't the reason. Sometimes it was just better, kinder, to keep up a front. Mostly she hadn't told because these things were her problems. What happened to Brett was her problem. And over the last 2 days she had come more and more to believe that what he did with his life would depend less on her and Joe in the final reckoning than it would on Brett himself. There would be no divorce. She would continue to fight her unceasing guerrilla war with Joe for the boy's soul, for whatever good that would do. In her worry over Brett's wanting to emulate his father, she had perhaps forgotten or overlooked the fact that there comes a time when children stand in judgment, and their parents, mother as well as father, must stand in the dock. Brett had noticed Holly's ostentatious display of credit cards. Charity could only hope Brett would notice that his father ate with his hat on, among other things. The dawn was brightening. She took her robe from the back of the door and put it on. She wanted a shower, but would not take one until the others in the house were stirring. The strangers, that was what they were. Even Holly's face was strange to her now, a face that bore only a faint resemblance to the snapshots in the family albums she had brought with them. Even Holly herself had looked at those photographs with a faint air of puzzlement. They would go back to Castle Rock, back to the house at the end of Town Road Number 3, back to Joe. She would pick up the threads of her life, and things would continue. That would be best. She reminded herself to call Alva just before 7 o'clock, when he would be at breakfast. It was just past 6 a.m., and the day was coming bright when Tad had his convulsion. He had awakened from an apparently sound sleep around 5:15 and had roused Donna from a low doze, complaining of being hungry and thirsty. As if he had pressed a button deep down inside her, Donna had become aware for the first time that she was hungry, too. The thirst she had been aware of, it was more or less constant, but she could not remember actually thinking of food since sometime yesterday morning. Now she was suddenly ravenous. She soothed Tad as best she could, telling him hollow things that no longer meant anything real to her one way or another. That people would show up soon, the bad dog would be taken away, they would be rescued. The real thing was the thought of food. Breakfasts, for instance. Take breakfasts. 2 eggs fried in butter. Over easy, if you don't mind, waiter. French toast. Big glasses of fresh-squeezed orange juice, so cold that moisture beaded the glass. Canadian bacon. Home fries. Bran flakes in cream with a sprinkle of blueberries on top. Bluebies, her father had always called them. Another one of those comic irrationalities that had irritated her mother out of all proportion. Her stomach made a loud rumbling sound, and Tad laughed. The sound of his laughter startled her and pleased her with its unexpectedness. It was like finding a rose growing in a rubbish heap, and she smiled back. The smile hurt her lips. Heard that, huh? I think you must be hungry, too. Well, I wouldn't turn down an Egg McMuffin if someone threw it my way. Tad groaned, and that made them both laugh again. In the yard, Cujo had pricked up his ears. He growled at the sound of their laughter. For a moment he made as if to get to his feet, perhaps to charge the car again. Then he settled wearily back on his haunches, head drooping. Donna felt that irrational lift in her spirits that almost always comes with daybreak. Surely it would be over soon. Surely they had passed the worst. All the luck had been against them, but sooner or later even the worst luck changes. Tad seemed almost his old self, too pale, badly used, terribly tired in spite of his sleep, but still indubitably the Tatter. She hugged him, and he hugged her back. The pain in her belly had subsided somewhat, although the scrapes and gouges there had a puffy, inflamed look. Her leg was worse, but she found she was able to flex it, although it hurt to do so, and the bleeding started again. She would have a scar. The two of them talked for the next 40 minutes or so. Donna, hunting for a way to keep Tad alert and to also pass the time for both of them, suggested 20 questions. Tad agreed eagerly. He had never been able to get enough of the game. The only problem had always been getting one or the other of his parents to play it with him. They were on their fourth game when the convulsion struck. Donna had guessed some 5 questions ago that the subject of the interrogation was Fred Redding, one of Tad's day camp chums, but had been spinning things out. "Does he have red hair?" she asked.
"No, he's...
Suddenly Tad was struggling to catch his breath. It came and went in gasping, tearing whoops that caused fear to leap up her throat in a sour, coppery-tasting rush. "Tad? Tad?" Tad gasped. He clawed at his throat, leaving red lines there. His eyes rolled up, showing only the bottoms of the irises and the silvery whites. "Tad!" She grabbed him, shook him. His Adam's apple went up and down rapidly, like a mechanical bear on a stick. His hands began to flop aimlessly about, and then they rose to his throat again and tore at it. He began to make animal choking sounds. For a moment, Donna entirely forgot where she was. She grabbed for the door handle, pulled it up, and shoved the door of the Pinto open, as if this had happened while she was in the supermarket parking lot and there was help close by. Cujo was on his feet in an instant. He leaped at the car before the door was more than half open, perhaps saving her from being savaged at that instant. He struck the opening door, fell back, and then came again, snarling thickly. Loose excrement poured onto the crushed gravel of the driveway. Screaming, she yanked the door closed. Cujo leaped at the side of the car again, bashing the dent in a little deeper. He reeled back, then sprang at the window, thudding off it with a dull cracking sound. The silver crack running through the glass suddenly developed 6 tributaries. He leaped at it again, and the safety glass starred inward, still holding together but sagging now. The outside world was suddenly a milky blur.
"If he comes again..."
Instead, Cujo withdrew, waiting to see what she would do next. She turned to her son. Tad's entire body was jerking as if with epilepsy. His back was bowed. His buttocks came out of the seat, thumped back, rose again, thumped back. His face was taking on a bluish color. The veins in his temples stood out prominently. She had been a candy striper for 3 years, her last 2 in high school and the summer following her freshman year at college, and she knew what was happening here. He had not swallowed his tongue. Outside of the more purple mystery novels, that was impossible. But his tongue had slid down his throat and was now blocking his windpipe. He was choking to death in front of her eyes. She grabbed his chin in her left hand and yanked his mouth open. Panic made her rough, and she heard the tendons in his jaw creak. Her probing fingers found the tip of his tongue incredibly far back, almost to where his wisdom teeth would be if they ever grew out. She tried to grip it and couldn't. It was as wet and slippery as a baby eel. She tried to tweeze it between her thumb and forefinger, only faintly aware of the lunatic race of her heart. "I think I'm losing him," she thought. "Oh, my dear God, I think I'm losing my son." End of side 7. To continue, turn the cassette over.